The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. First, the People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon. Can a vitamin really help prevent skin cancer? Question. As a middle-aged, fair-skinned redhead, I have had several run-ins with precancerous and basal skin cell cancers. I see my dermatologist every 6 months and usually have many rough precancerous spots burned off, particularly from the back of my hands. My friend's son lives in Australia, and she told me about studies there showing that niacinamide supplements reduce the incidence of precancerous cell growth. I've been taking 500 milligrams of niacinamide supplements daily for the past year and have had zero recurrence of these rough spots on my hands. Have you heard anything about taking niacinamide to prevent some skin cancers? Answer, your friend is right that Australian dermatologists and scientists have done most of the studies in this arena. One recent review of the research concludes that niacinamide, another name for, nicotinamide, another name for niacinamide, holds promise for preventing both melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancers. And that was cited in Photodermatology, Photoimmunology, and Photomedicine online, July 5th, 2017. Another summary concludes that nicotinamide acts in several ways to reduce actinic keratoses, your rough spots, and non-melanoma skin cancers. And that's cited in the Australasian Journal of Dermatology, August 2017. Thank you for letting us know of your success. Question, can you recommend a natural alternative to help reduce blood sugar levels? At my last lab test, my fasting blood sugar was 119, though it should be under 100. Your recent fasting blood sugar result was a wake-up call. There are a number of tactics you might want to try. In addition to adding cinnamon to your daily diet, preferably in a water-based extract, you may want to cut back on pasta and rice. Vegetables such as cauliflower and squash might be substitutes that wouldn't raise blood sugar much. You also might want to finish your meal with salad dressed with vinaigrette. Vinegar helps to prevent blood sugar spikes after eating, and that's cited in Diabetes Research and Clinical Practice, May 2017. New generic version of Viagra could offer substantial savings. Question, the last time I filled a prescription for Viagra, they wanted $400 for 6 pills. That's insane. I pushed the prescription back across the counter and walked out. Answer, depending upon the pharmacy, Viagra could cost as much as $65 to $80 per pill. A generic version has just become available because the patent on Viagra has expired. That means substantial savings. Greenstone, a subsidiary of Viagra maker Pfizer, will sell an authorized generic version for approximately half the price. That means you are getting the same quality at a reduced price. It's still not cheap, however. Brand name Viagra from Canada costs even less. According to PharmacyChecker.com, the per-pill price ranges from about $14 to $20 from a legitimate Canadian source. Generic Viagra from Canada is even less expensive, but there is no guarantee you would be buying the authorized generic. Because of its popularity, Viagra has been widely counterfeited. In the United Kingdom, men soon will have the opportunity to buy Viagra without a prescription. Question, my wife had severe asthma for 35 years, from the time she was a little girl. She has used all sorts of inhalers, and sometimes she needed oral prednisone. Then, in middle age, she developed nail fungus. The doctor finally prescribed oral itraconazole, or Sporinax, to clear it up. She had to take this antifungal medicine for more than a year while the nails grew out. Several months into the treatment, she realized that her asthma was better. By the end of the treatment, she no longer had asthma. She hasn't needed any asthma medicine since, and that was decades ago. Have you ever heard of such a thing? Answer. Some people with hard-to-manage asthma have an allergic response to a fungus that has colonized their airways, and that's cited in the Journal of Asthma, September 2016. This condition can be treated with antifungal medicine, and that's cited in Medical Mycology Case Reports, April 25th, 2017. Such drugs are tricky, though, as they often interact with other medicine and carry a range of risks. Another medication that may help hard-to-treat asthma is the antibiotic azithromycin. A randomized controlled trial called AMAZES, A-M-A-Z-E-S, showed that people taking azithromycin along with asthma inhalers had fewer flare-ups and better quality of life. And that's in The Lancet, August 12, 2017. From the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, pulmonary embolism, common life-threatening condition. During recovery from your hip replacement surgery, your surgical team seemed concerned about blood flow in your legs. The staff had you up and walking sooner than you had expected, and you were put on a blood-thinning medication to prevent blood clots. These post-surgical steps may sometimes seem like a lot of fuss, but they're very important for preventing potentially life preventing a potentially life-threatening problem called pulmonary embolism. This most commonly occurs when fragments of a blood clot or an emboli in a leg vein break loose and travel through your bloodstream to a lung. Once there, the clot fragments can become lodged in a blood vessel, cutting off critical blood flow through the lung. This can cause damage to the lung, reduce oxygen supply to the body, and if emboli block enough of the blood supply, result in death. It's estimated that about 60 to 100,000 people die of pulmonary embolism each year in the United States. The risk of pulmonary embolism rises rapidly after age 60. The clot thickens. Having a blood clot in a leg vein, a condition known as deep vein thrombosis or DVT, is the usual precursor to a pulmonary embolism. DVT typically occurs in the large veins of the legs or pelvis located deep in the muscle tissue. Veins are the blood vessels that carry oxygen-depleted blood to the right side of the heart, which then pumps blood into the lungs to once again become oxygen-rich. Most people who develop DVT are predisposed to quicker clotting for reasons that may include, number one, a past incident of DVT or pulmonary embolism, number two, medical circumstances that require immobility, number three, use of estrogen replacement therapy, next, a family history of blood clots, next, factors such as obesity and smoking, next, older age as tiny valves and larger leg veins that help move blood along in the right direction tend to deteriorate. Having certain cancers, especially pancreatic, brain, lymph node, and lung cancers, or chemotherapy. In addition to predisposing factors, any one of several situations may be a triggering event leading to DVT and possibly pulmonary embolism, such as long periods of sitting in bed or bed rest, inactivity slows blood flow in the veins. Bed rest due to a medical problem or hospitalization can be a cause of inactivity. Airplane flights that are around 6 hours or more also can be culprits, as can long car train rides. Hospitalization or major surgery. In addition to the risks of bed rest, trauma to the leg area or pelvis, such as a fracture, puts you at especially high risk. In addition, certain surgical procedures, particularly orthopedic procedures in the hip or leg area, can greatly increase clotting risk. DVT clots can develop and grow quite large before causing any signs or symptoms. Still, most cause signs and symptoms eventually, which may include redness or warmth over the affected area, fever, swelling in the ankle area or the affected leg, or leg plant pain or cramping that often starts in the calf. If you or your doctor suspects DVT, prompt treatment is crucial, not only for treating the DVT, but also for preventing or possibly treating pulmonary embolism. Sometimes DVT symptoms may be the only sign of pulmonary embolism. About half the people diagnosed with DVT also have pulmonary embolism. In the lungs, signs and symptoms of pulmonary embolism can vary depending on what part or how much of your lungs are affected. Many people don't have signs and symptoms or have symptoms that are mild and vague. However, pulmonary embolism can also cause fairly sudden and alarming symptoms. Seek immediate medical care for unexplained shortness of breath, which can come on suddenly or gradually, whether you're active or at rest, sharp chest pain when taking a deep breath or when coughing, feeling lightheaded, dizzy, or even rarely fainting, a rapid or irregular heart rate, clammy or bluish skin, or excessive sweating. Pulmonary embolism can be difficult to detect in part because of the often mild symptoms. More pronounced symptoms can mimic something else, such as a heart attack, heart failure, or pneumonia. Narrowing down the cause of symptoms may involve tests to rule out or confirm various possibilities. Often, a risk factor checklist for pulmonary embolism can help highlight this as a possible cause. Blood testing can help further narrow suspicion of pulmonary embolism. A computerized tomography or CT scan can help confirm or rule out a diagnosis. Once the immediate threat has passed, finding the cause of the clot is part of the future prevention. Stopping further harm. In most cases, people with pulmonary embolisms are in stable condition. The goal in these situations is to stop any clots in the lungs from getting bigger, to keep new clots from forming, and to stabilize existing clots, whether they are lung clots or DVT. This provides relative safety from the condition worsening, giving body enzymes the weeks to months needed to naturally dissolve the problem clots. Clot stabilization is achieved with one of several drugs, often referred to as blood thinners, that reduce your blood's ability to clot. Before an anti-clotting drug is delivered, an assessment is made to determine the risk of the drug causing harmful bleeding. If the risk is acceptable, a fast-acting drug such as heparin is often used first, either intravenously or by injection. If you started on heparin, you'll likely be transitioned to an oral anticoagulant after a few days. These may include warfarin, which is Coumadin or Jantoven, apixaban, which is Eliquis, dabigatran, which is Pradaxa, etodexban, Cevesa, or rivaroxaban, Xarelto. Apixaban or rivaroxaban may sometimes be initiated right away without using heparin. No matter which medication you end up taking, work with your doctor to monitor your risk of developing harmful bleeding and to make sure your drug dose remains appropriate over time. You'll need to keep taking the anti-clotting drug until your doctor says it's okay to stop. The usual minimum is at least 3 months, but the drug may be needed for 6 months or longer, or even indefinitely, depending on the risk of recurrence. If it's too risky for you to take an anti-clotting drug due to bleeding risk, or if anti-clotting drugs aren't working, a thin tube may be used to place a clot-trapping filter in a large vein in your abdomen that leads from your legs to your heart. Unstable conditions. In potentially life-threatening situations in which your vital functions are unstable, potent clot-dissolving drugs, thrombolytics, may be used. These can dissolve a clot in the lungs or legs fairly quickly, but they also can cause sudden severe bleeding. They're typically reserved for people with life-threatening pulmonary embolism and low bleeding risk. Very rarely, lung clots may be removed surgically, either using catheters threaded through veins or as open surgery. Preventing clots. If you're at an elevated risk of deep vein thrombosis or pulmonary embolism, help avoid clot formation by 1. Following instructions from your doctor or surgeon. There are well-established guidelines for preventing clots, whether using compression stockings, exercising, taking anti-clotting drugs, or taking other steps. It's important to follow the clot-preventing steps for the recommended time. And the next, taking precautions when traveling for 6 hours or longer. Avoid sitting for long periods by taking a walk around the airplane every hour or so. If traveling by car, stop every hour to walk around. You can also flex your calf muscles by rotating your ankles, pressing your feet against the footrest, or moving your toes up and down. Staying hydrated and avoiding alcohol are helpful, as well as wearing compression stockings and perhaps taking low-dose aspirin. If you're at especially high risk, your doctor may prescribe an anti-clotting drug. Health tips. Safe turkey prep. Improperly handled and prepared poultry, including holiday turkeys, is among the top causes of foodborne illness in the United States. Keep your holiday guests healthy and happy by, number one, thawing poultry properly. Thaw your turkey in the refrigerator in a juice-catching pan, not on the counter. It can take several days to thaw a large turkey this way. A thawed turkey can remain in the refrigerator 1 to 2 days. Two, practicing good kitchen hygiene. Wash your hands before handling food and immediately after handling a turkey. Don't reuse rags, towels, utensils, dishes, or pans that have come in contact with turkey juice unless they've been washed thoroughly. Wash and sanitize the sink and counter after turkey handling. Third, not rinsing your turkey. This isn't necessary, and it can spread bacteria to other foods and around the sink and counter. Proper cooking destroys bacteria. Four, cooking meat to temperature. Set your oven no lower than 325 degrees Fahrenheit. Using a meat thermometer placed deep in the turkey, cook to a minimum internal temperature of 165 degrees Fahrenheit. Don't rely on plastic pop-up timers. Cook stuffing in a casserole dish before putting it in the turkey. When the turkey is done cooking, test the internal temperature of the stuffing to make sure it's at least 165 degrees Fahrenheit. Storing leftovers properly. Refrigerate or freeze leftover turkey within 2 hours. Once carved, place meat in a shallow pan initially for faster cooking. News and our views. Anti-clotting drugs. You may not be getting the right dose. Predictable dosing is a major advantage of newer anti-clotting drugs over the older anti-clotting standard drug, warfarin or Coumadin or Jantavin. Newer drugs, including Eliquis, Pradaxa, Cevesa, and Xarelto, don't require routine ongoing blood testing to monitor and calibrate drug dose, unlike warfarin. However, that may not mean that dosing is always spot on. Mayo Clinic research suggests that about 16% of people taking a newer anti-clotting drug for the heart rhythm problem, atrial fibrillation, aren't getting the appropriate dose. The research looked mostly at older adults with atrial fibrillation. A portion of the study participants had severe kidney disease, which caused diminished kidney function. With diminished clearance, the drug stays in the body longer and is therefore more potent than it would be in someone without diminished clearance. For this reason, guidelines for newer anti-clotting drugs call for a lower than usual dose for people with diminished kidney function. However, according to the study, 43% of those with diminished kidney function were prescribed the normal dose. Among people with mild kidney disease or no kidney disease, about 13% were prescribed a drug dose that was too low. Based on this research, Mayo experts recommend that people taking a newer anti-clotting drug ask their doctors to make sure they're on the right dose based on kidney function. Over time, it's also worth asking about periodically rechecking kidney function to identify any changes. In addition, experts advise you to avoid taking other drugs, such as aspirin, that can increase bleeding risk unless your doctor has you taking the drug for a specific reason. Best and worst foods for your health. New evidence suggests that when you eat, what you eat can influence your risk of various diseases. In a study published in March 2017, the Journal of the American Medical Association scientists determined the top foods likely to lead to death from cardiometabolic health conditions such as heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes. Based on data representative of the U.S. population, the researchers concluded that some foods that are detrimental to health are consumed in excess. These include sodium, processed meats, unprocessed red meats, and sugar-sweetened beverages. Meanwhile, foods that are beneficial to health aren't consumed enough, researchers said. These include nuts, seeds, fish, vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and polyunsaturated fats such as olive oil. Mayo Clinic doctors advise eating a diet focused on vegetables, fruits, whole grains, nuts, seeds, low-fat dairy products, healthy fats such as olive or vegetable oils, and lean products including fish and beans. Approximately three-fourths of the sodium people consume comes from processed food. If you think you might be getting too much sodium in your diet, consider eating mostly unprocessed whole foods and adding flavor with spices rather than salt. Second opinion. My doctor says that exercise is even better than calcium supplements for helping maintain bone density and prevent fractures. Can you explain why? Both calcium and physical activity are important for bone health, but when you consider the net benefits of calcium, especially in supplement form, it's unlikely to serve as a good substitute for regular exercise. Calcium is an important mineral that your body uses to build and maintain strong bones. Foods that are high in calcium include dairy products, dark green leafy vegetables, and certain fish, such as sardines. A variety of foods and beverages, such as cereals and fruit juices, may be fortified with calcium and vitamin D, as vitamin D enhances absorption of calcium. Calcium in supplement form may be helpful for people who can't get enough calcium from the diets or who poorly absorb calcium because of conditions such as untreated celiac disease or after bariatric surgery. However, recent evidence suggests that increasing calcium intake through supplements has a modest and limited effect on bone density. Calcium supplements can also have certain side effects. They can cause constipation, interfere with other drugs, and at higher doses may be linked to development of kidney stones. Studies suggest a potential link between excessive amounts of calcium and conditions such as heart disease and prostate cancer. On the other hand, regular exercise that uses a variety of muscle groups and includes some strength training helps you build a protective framework around your skeleton. It also helps you move more easily and improves your balance. Exercise helps decrease your risk of falling and breaking a bone, which is the ultimate concern. Ingesting and recommended daily amounts of calcium, primarily through dietary sources, and staying physically active appears to be the best approach to limit your fracture risk. Chronic cough. Finding the cause. Coughing is a normal protective reaction to irritants in your respiratory system. Coughing on occasion or during an illness forcefully expels mucus, food particles, noxious gases, and foreign bodies in order to clear your airways. However, a cough that lasts longer than 6 to 8 weeks may be a sign of an underlying problem or disease. Persistent, vigorous coughing also can damage your vocal cords, rupture small blood vessels in your airway, cause fainting spells, embarrassing urinary or fecal incontinence, hernias, or even broken ribs. It can be embarrassing in public and interfere with sleep and social activity. Frequent doctor appointments and rounds of seemingly ineffective therapy can be extremely stressful. It's no wonder that a persistent cough can be frustrating and may cause worry, anger, and hopelessness. Finding the cause of a cough that lasts longer than 6 to 8 weeks involves systematically eliminating or identifying probable causes with various diagnostic steps or by treating a possible cause to see if it helps reduce coughing. Partnership with the care provider and a thoughtful and disciplined approach is necessary. The most common causes of cough are listed in the chart below. Underlying cause, postnasal drip of varying causes, allergies, irritants, sinus or nasal inflammation can cause irritating secretions. Treatment options, Avoid identified irritants such as smoke, pollens, and animal hair or dander. Regular saline nasal rinses can help clear nasal mucus. One or more nasal sprays may include an antihistamine. An oral decongestant with older generation oral antihistamines can be effective, but can cause intolerable side effects in older adults. GERD, or gastroesophageal reflux disease, is an underlying cause, and this occurs when stomach contents back up into the esophagus, possibly reaching the voice box. GERD causes irritation and can trigger coughing. The most important lifestyle change is to avoid eating 3 or 4 hours before lying down. Others include using blocks to elevate the head of your bed 6 to 8 inches, maintaining a healthy weight, avoiding common trigger foods such as fatty foods, chocolate, alcohol, caffeine, or peppermint, eating smaller meals, and not smoking. And if heartburn is present, using a proton pump inhibitor. Eosinophilic bronchitis, or asthma or non-asthma type, a cough caused by this specific airway inflammation may or may not be accompanied by a prior history of asthma or episodes of wheezing and breathing difficulty. A cough can also be the only sign of asthma, a condition called cough variant asthma. Treatment options. The mainstay of treatment is inhaled asthma medications, particularly inhaled corticosteroids to calm inflammation. Since asthma medications come in different inhaler types, work with your doctor or pharmacist to make sure you're using your inhaler properly. Angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, ACE inhibitors, taken to lower blood pressure, treat heart failure, or treat heart attack. These drugs are notorious for causing a chronic cough, and it may occur soon after you start taking the drug, or may start months or years later. The treatment is switched to a drug that's not an ACE inhibitor class. Be patient. It can take up to a month before coughing subsides. Finally, infection-related, sinusitis, bronchiectasis, tuberculosis, and whooping cough, or pertussis, can cause chronic coughing. Older adults exposed to young children are susceptible to frequent colds or viral upper respiratory infection, and particularly respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, syncytial. Treatment, pertussis, bronchiectasis, and bacterial sinus infections may require antibiotic therapy. Persistent coughing after a cold may be due to ongoing sinusitis, postnasal drip, or airway hyperactivity. Next week, we're going to discuss the question, my grandson frequently has a runny nose, and the color of the snot, for lack of a better term, is sometimes green to yellowish. I've heard that this is a sign of a bacterial infection and perhaps the need for antibiotics. Can you confirm? So we'll talk about that next time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and be healthy.